Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Attention, collectors of vinyl. Have you ever gone into a record store and felt overwhelmed by all the unfamiliar options? Are you frustrated by the constantly increasing prices of classic rock staples? Do you avoid streaming music or long for the days when music was recommended to you by a friend instead of an algorithm? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then check out I'd Buy That for a Dollar, a podcast about inexpensive, common, and underappreciated records that are waiting to be rediscovered. Each week, hosts Sean, Jeremy, and Peter discuss an album and the artist's history. Previous episodes include selections by the Isley Brothers, the Carpenters, the Doobie Brothers, and Donna Summer, among others. Become a bargain bin pro and impress all your friends with cool music trivia. Listen to I'd Buy That for a Dollar wherever you get your podcasts.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Please consider supporting Black Women United, YEG, for the protection and advancement of Black women and girls in Alberta. You can learn more about them at bwunited.ca. They are always looking for donations and volunteers. So please, again, support Black Women United, YEG, for the protection and advancement of Black women and girls in Alberta. Again, that website is bwunited.ca.
Hi, this is Mark Lee Morrison from the podcast Low Profile. I live in Olympia, Washington with my wife and two daughters, and I support Vish Khanna's Creative Control on Patreon because I appreciate his journalistic integrity. Vish talks with a lot of artists I care about, and he never asks any boring questions. I love hearing his interviews, and as a Patreon supporter, I get to hear even more of them. If you enjoy Creative Control too, I implore you to join me as a sustaining contributor.
To make your flexible monthly donation to Creative Control, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today.
Suvankam Tamavangsa is a talented author and poet who was raised and is currently based in Toronto, Ontario. Born in a refugee camp in Thailand after her parents fled Laos, Tamavangsa is a published poet whose 4 works are acclaimed and have earned her a Trillium Book Award for Poetry and also a Relit Award. In 2020, McClelland and Stewart published her first work of fiction, a stunning short story collection called How to Pronounce Knife, which went on to win Canada's most prestigious annual fiction award, the 2020 Scotiabank Giller Prize, for which she received $100,000. Suvankam and I connected again recently to have a chat about Toronto groceries and our immigrant parents' home cooking. Our mutual friend, Sean Michaels, who also once won the Giller Prize. Her book, How to Pronounce Knife, Public Perceptions of Poetry and Prose, Writing and Regionalism, Boxing and Social Media, Future Plans, and much more. A part of the Entertainment One Network with the support of listeners like you who follow and subscribe to this podcast and spread the word about it and make flexible monthly donations at patreon.com/creativecontrol and Massey Hall's concert film series live at masseyhall.com where you can stream dozens of 30-minute films for free, including performances by past podcast guests like Basha Bulat, plus in-kind support from Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton. This is the 592nd episode of Creative Control, featuring the multi-award-winning writer Suvankam Tamavangsa with your host, me, Vish Khanna. Hi, Sue. How's it going?
It's going well. Hello. How are you?
I'm well. Where in the world are you today?
In Toronto.
How are things going in Toronto? Oh, I should say, it's as we're speaking, it's only a couple days into January. Happy New Year, first of all. Let me go with that. Happy New Year, Sue.
You too. Happy New Year.
Has it been a Happy New Year thus far?
It's only been 2 days. every day feels the same, though. Well, I guess I should just say yes, yes. It's been a happy New Year.
It is. Every day does feel exactly the same. Remember when days, like, you'd be like, oh, it totally is Sunday. It feels like Sunday. And now, like, every day kind of feels like that weird Thursday-Sunday feeling, you know? Like, you're on the cusp.
Yeah.
Everything feels like something's going to happen the next day, and then it kind of doesn't. That's how I feel. Do you have that?
Yeah, I can relate.
Yeah. So you're in Toronto. How are things generally for you in Toronto? Is everything cool?
Yeah, I saw some snow. We're in lockdown, so I don't... But I felt like even when we weren't, I just behaved like we were. So I just didn't do anything except read and write.
Right, okay. Are you going and getting groceries?
Oh, yes, I've done that, but I've also sometimes had the groceries delivered.
Interesting. I did it once, and it was a slight ordeal because
I heard about this app called Gocery, Gocery, and it's purposely misspelled, and they only deliver, like, Asian food.
Oh.
That's why I order from them, because this is food that you can't just go to any grocery store for.
Is that like a Toronto thing or is it like national?
I think it's just for Toronto.
Oh, so what kinds of things? Wait. What kinds of things would you order from Gocery, if I might ask? What kinds of items?
I really love guava, and so I order that from them a lot, or sticky rice, or special noodles, specific handmade noodles, which they have at their store.
Okay. So are you steeped in sort of traditional cooking? Is that something you do? Because I'm lamenting that I didn't pay enough attention to my mother's cooking, particularly since I don't know if you know this, but my family moved to Edmonton, Alberta from Ontario.
Oh,
so
yeah.
I'm very far away from my parents and the Indian cooking.
Have you kind of had to invent things on your own or go by memory?
Well, my mom did give us some recipes, and actually maybe 3 weeks ago, my wife actually was like, you know what? We have too much cauliflower. We have too many potatoes. Let's make some Indian food. And I bought some naan bread from somewhere. I can't remember where I got it from. And so we did. We actually had Indian food. And I got to say, my wife handled most of the Indian food. And she did a great job. I was like, this is pretty close. Like, we were using my mom's recipe. So That's how I usually gauge. I don't know about you. First of all, for those who don't know, where are you actually? Where's your family from, if I may ask?
Oh, my mom and dad are from Laos, and they both live in Toronto.
Oh, they're there. Okay.
Yeah.
So you're from, your family history is from Laos, and so my parents are from India, and so I just didn't pay enough attention to what was going on in the kitchen. I don't know. I feel badly.
Same here. Yeah. You know, I had my mom's cooking, and I took it for granted because it was always at home anytime. But then when I moved away, I realized that there are no restaurants that cook like her. So I can't just order takeout, you know. And there's no, like, recipe that she follows. It's just by sight.
I see.
And,
right.
Like, you know, a dash here. And there's no measurement at all. Like,
yeah.
A spoon here, you know, of this and that. And then it suddenly becomes the thing. So I've really kind of had to memorize how she did it and go by, like, memory.
And trial and error, I assume.
Yeah.
I had the same thing. Not exact measurements, but I do, when I go to an Indian restaurant, I gauge how great it is by how close it is to my mom's cooking.
Oh.
And a lot, because I will say, and I'm not just being braggadocious here, in her community in Ontario, my mother is regarded as like the top level cook.
Wow. So, and you were able to eat that like every day in your childhood.
Absolutely. Well, but I don't know about you, but I grew up kind of resenting a bit of the cultural stuff. Like I was born in Canada. Were you born in Canada?
Yeah.
Were you born in Canada?
No, I was born in Thailand. My parents left Laos and then we lived in a refugee camp in Thailand, and that's where I was born.
Wow. Okay. So when did you arrive in Canada? How old were you?
I was a year old in 1980.
Okay. So ostensibly you know nothing but a Canadian.
The food.
Well, no, I was going to say, I was born here, so I've been to India only once. How often have you been back to Thailand?
Never.
You've never been. Okay, so there
no,
you go.
No, I mean, my parents have gone, but I feel like I'm not emotionally ready, you know. That, you know, people think that's where you're from, and you yourself in your mind think that's where you're from, but what if you go there and then the very people who are from there say, oh, you're not from here. You can't, right? And then you're just rejected and you belong nowhere.
Right. I had that a little bit. Like, I went when I was 12. And, you know, when I distinctly remember walking through the streets of Delhi, and I was wearing, I've always been into Batman, and I had from the Kmart, I had a very loud shirt that had the Joker from Batman, like a comic book characterization of the Joker, and his just giant, white, maniacal, laughing face. And so I was wearing this sweatshirt and, like, probably some sort of pants, corduroys or something, and every other kid that I encountered around my age was in a kurta pajama. I don't know if they just got back from school or what was going on, but everyone was dressed uniformly. So they would gawk at me. You know, I looked like a freak. And I had a real cultural clash. Like, we spent like 6 weeks there, and it was hard for me. And
Were you able to talk to other people? Like,
They were also, I should say, like, you know, unfortunately our brains have a negative bias. Like, now that I'm talking about it, I've cherry picked a moment that was kind of weird, but there were lots of kids who were very fascinated by me and by us, you know, living in a different place, because for them it's like it was literally a whole other world, you know.
Yeah.
And I mean, your circumstance for your parents to leave was obviously very traumatizing. So my parents' situation, I don't know if there was trauma of any kind, but I was just having this conversation with someone the other day about how immigration is a very curious thing if you don't ask a lot of questions about it, if you don't get to ask a lot of questions about it, because, like, my parents willingly moved across the world, away from their parents. There's got to be something to that. Like, there must be.
Yeah.
Like, they must have needed to leave. not only leave, yeah. like I'm not, it's not like I am moving across the country. I'm moving to a whole other part of the world that yeah. I don't know anything about. That's how much I don't want to be here. That's, yeah. that is got to be significant. Can you imagine doing that now? You haven't even been to Thailand once.
No.
Right, right.
I know, like I think back, you know, like when I turned, when I was in my early 20s, I was thinking about how different like my life was from my parents because there I was still living at home, whereas my parents like built a raft made of bamboo to get to another country just to remarkable. Live in a refugee yeah. camp. And I'm scared to take the bus at night.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it is pretty remarkable. And I mean, I think some of that stuff is swimming around in your latest book, How to Pronounce Knife, mm-hmm. I want to get to. Oh, I didn't say this yet. Congratulations, you won you won a big prize, didn't you?
Can you believe it? I mean, I still can't believe it, because also when you win a prize, you understand the value of that prize by the public reaction or the room's reaction. You read it on the face of the people around you. But because I run it and I was in my living room,
oh right. And, yeah.
Right? Like to me, it hasn't sunk in that it's true. I mean,
it is true. It's very true. You are the winner of the 2020 Scotiabank Giller Prize. So
also, I don't want to rest on that idea. Like somehow there is, I should stop now, or
yeah.
or that I need to take a break. I just feel like I kind of want to set it aside and maybe not think about it for a while.
Yeah. So you and I were going over this over email a little bit. The first time you and I spoke formally, and I think that's the first time we met.
On stage,
you were on my Long Night talk show at Long Winter. And I knew you as a poet. I think I'd reached out to Sheila Hedy.
Yeah.
About, having her on the show to talk about a new volume of work that she had edited. Had you contributed to that volume? Do you know the one?
Yeah, the anthology, Women in Clothes.
Yes.
I had, she had asked for a survey, and I submitted a survey of her in responses to the questions in the survey. And they were going to pick a few things from the survey to just kind of put together, but she loved everything I said and ended up publishing the whole survey response.
Wow. Okay. And at the time, you were more known as a poet, yes?
A poet. Known, I don't know about that word.
But you were,
but,
you had...
Okay, if you sure.
you had published volumes of poetry at that point, I believe.
Yes.
I have them. You gifted them to me that night, as I recall. So thank you for those. So you were okay. Do you want to say you were an aspiring poet? You were a poet. You
just because aspiring would mean that I don't have books. But at the time, I did have 3 books of poetry. So I guess it is safe to say that I am a poet. Yeah.
I mean, didn't you win?
I won the Trillium. I won the Trillium Prize for poetry.
Yeah. You are a prize winner. Every time you publish something, someone comes around and says, guess what? We want to give you an award. So there's something going on with you, Sue. I mean, people like what you do. So anyway, we met on stage, and you were very, yes. as I recall, I can't remember who else was on the show. Do you remember who else was on the show?
Shawn Michaels.
Well, yeah, Shawn, my
good. He had just won the Giller.
That's right. He had just won the Giller for his wonderful book, Us Conductors, and Shawn and I were friends. I think it was a surprise. My friend James had arranged, I didn't know Shawn was in town. And he was like a walk. What is it called? He was like a pop in guest. He did a walk on, and I don't know if you remember, but I was very emotional. I was like excited that Sean was there.
Yeah.
And so anyway, and you two, did you know Sean at that point?
No, that was the first time I met him.
Oh, okay. There you go. So it was and have you stayed in touch a little bit?
I have. When I was longlisted for the Giller, he sent me an email to congratulate me.
Oh.
And I told him that it's very hard to stay grounded and to not want the prize, to be so close to it and to not want it. I didn't know how to feel about it and to stay grounded. And he said, well, you know, juries are fickle. And and, you know, the universe can be, you know, unkind. So steel yourself, but enjoy this moment.
He gave you a force field, basically. Just,
yeah.
You got to actually let it go. As soon as you're nominated, yeah. You got to let it go.
Yeah.
'Cause it's,
to not let your mind go there and think it could be you. I mean, that I found really difficult to do, and I knew that that's where the pain would come in.
Well, it's a very astute piece of advice, I would think, for anyone who does anything in the public sector, because once you've, I assume, like a lot of people, you make things and create things ostensibly for yourself, but
of course, and
but there's going to be an external reception to it because of the nature of the work. Someone else is going to read it and then maybe opine about it. And like you say, you have to steel yourself for the worst, but then also similarly take the compliments, the awards, the plaudits, all of that you have to take with a grain of salt as well.
Right. But also the thing I know about a prize is that prizes don't make books. Writers do.
Right.
The prize comes after. Like, everything I could possibly do for the book had already been done a year ago. The prize doesn't change a sentence or a scene or a paragraph. It's all done and it has been printed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it does, when you win, you do get a kind of visibility that even, you know, a good book can't get for itself just because it's good.
Yeah. Did you have the experience that even when you were on the long or short list that people were paying more attention to the book? I know that's, I don't mean to get too personal or crass here, but I mean, that would normally be gauged by book sales, I assume. But, and I suppose interview requests and things like that. You sensed something was happening to the book upon being nominated, even, I'm guessing?
I sensed something was, I mean, even before the Giller, because, you know, I'd only been writing poetry.
Right.
So
right.
I did sense the minute that I wrote, like, a fiction book, there was a different kind of attention and a different kind of machine. Like, when my book came out, you know, when you write poetry books, you can't expect somebody will send you on tour, or you can't expect even review space. Mm. But I saw, you know, in print, places like the New York Times, the New Yorker, the Washington Post, the Globe and Mail, they were giving the book space just on lists or just giving it review space. So I did sense that this is something that's very different from poetry. And then when I got on the long list, bookstores were, especially bookstores, they were excited. They were putting it on in the display window of their stores.
Yeah.
And that I hadn't seen before.
I think for whatever reason, there's a certain segment of the book reading populace that really responds to book contests, or in Canada, we have Canada Reads. I know when that occurs, people go nuts over those books, and those books start flying off the shelves a little bit. The Giller Prize, similarly, when the long list, short list are announced, and of course, when the winner's announced, people will say, okay, well, thank you. Thank you for curating my reading experience. I'm going to get a copy of that book. And I guess that happens with music and movies and stuff too. It's interesting. Yeah. I think it's just like, well, this must be good. So,
well, I think we're really, as readers, we're not curious. We're afraid to be our own tastemakers, to pick up a book nobody's ever heard of and say, you know what, this is good, and I'm going to decide that it's good.
Yeah.
And I'm going to read it, and I'm going to tell my friends about it. We often wait for someone else to come along and say that this is good.
Yeah, that's fair.
But, you know,
Is it the investment of the time? Like, because reading is more than you can't just listen to a song and 3 minutes later have an opinion. Like, to read a book, you got to be all in and, you know, spend however long it takes you to read a book. Is that it? I don't quite understand, because I was going to ask you about the distinction you were making between poetry and prose. What does that say about poetry? What does that say about the state of poetry that it is not regarded as not even as high a form, but as exciting a form, as resonant a form as prose? Like, you've had the experience of releasing award-winning poetry, but still not getting press, if you will, or attention. But prose does it. Why is that? Why do you think that is?
I think it's how we're educated. Often I hear from teachers saying, you know, my students don't like poetry, so I'm excited about this new fiction book of yours.
Ugh.
But but it, you know, it's
But I don't the children, if I may yeah. If I may call everyone the children, don't the children like songs? Don't they like rapping?
Yeah.
Don't they like poetry and other forms? What is it about the printed? I know that it's not my thing, but people really like spoken word, like slam poetry or whatever. People like different kinds of poetry, but there's something about the written word. It's like it feels like school to them or something to have to read a poem, and a contemporary poem. And I find that weird, because I'm a person, when I get a record, if there's a lyric sheet, I read along. I read the lyric sheet along with the words, because I'm very along with the singing, I mean, because I'm very interested in what the words are. But maybe am I an anomaly? Why don't people care about
it? Probably.
That's weird.
Well, I think, one thing that, you know, this working in poetry and in prose, what I've seen is that anyone who buys a poetry book feels like a miracle.
Right.
Because they've come on their own and they made their own choices. There was no algorithm or no influencer who pushed them to come to your poetry book. And they came to it and they chose it and they took it home and they cared about it.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you write fiction and it's good, then people start calling it poetic.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't understand either.
That's a good point.
But also, I guess I try not, I mean, even though it is on my mind, I try not to think so much about, you know, why people react the way that they do. I think people are fickle. And at the end of the day, I can only write something that I love to read. And that's what I want to put out there.
Yeah, no, that's fair. I wonder if there's just, I don't want to dwell on this too much longer, but I wonder if there's a perception of poets versus a perception of authors as
well.
For
sure. Well, like in fiction, there's the idea that like it's more glamorous in fiction. Mm. And also the idea that poets are, all they do is do drugs and smoke and are bad.
You're speaking of beat poets from the 1950s right. or something. I don't think that... Is that perception still in play?
Is that... I don't... Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
I think so.
It's like beat poets and Tupac, I think, is who you're describing. Everyone else is not... I don't think they're doing that stuff. Now, that night we met, as I recall, as I often do, as people who listen to this show know, I will often wrap up an interview by saying, you know, what's next? Or what are you working on? What are you hoping to accomplish? Do you recall, and I know you recall this because we had the email exchange, what did you say to me on stage when I did that? When I said, what do you want to accomplish? What's going on?
I said, well, because Sean was there and everyone seemed so excited about what he was doing, I wanted to do that too. So I said, the Giller.
That's right. Which was kind of audacious, but what was the reaction in the room? Did we all laugh?
Yeah, you laughed, and because everyone thought that was cute.
Well, it was a funny, it was a joke. It was a good reading of the room joke. Like, you're right, Sean was there. So it was, I wonder if he wasn't there, if you would have said the same thing. But I think that was oddly prescient. You thought of this moment upon winning, I guess, a little bit. Was it in your head?
No, you have to, I mean, at the time it was a joke, but Yeah, you can't have it in your head
no.
because
okay.
it will be heartbreaking and disappointing. Anybody who wrote a fiction book this year, I mean, in 2020, thought that they would win or, you know, qualified to be in the running for the Giller.
Yeah.
And that's, there are many books published in 2020 and, you know, they weren't there.
I feel particularly badly for you because I know that the kind of social aspect of literary festivals and an award show like this is really important to authors. I'd interviewed Damian Rogers about her latest book recently, and she was relating a conversation she had with Leanne Batasimasak Simpson. They both released books in 2020, and because mm-hmm. there was no convening of any kind, mm-hmm. you know, at festivals mm-hmm. or whatever, Damian said that Leanne remarked, it's like we didn't even release books this year. Like, it's like they didn't even come out.
Well, for me, as you know, that is an experience I know very well because I come from poetry.
Right.
So for me, it wasn't a disappointment. This was like, oh, well, I've seen this before and I know what to do with this kind of quiet and this silence.
Right. Okay. Now, let's get into the book is called How to Pronounce Knife, and it's a wonderful collection of short stories. I guess, I hope this isn't too trite a way to begin, but short stories versus a long-form novel. You're getting into prose from your time as a poet, I suppose. What appealed to you about the short story structure for this particular volume?
I liked the brutality of the short story.
The brutality of it?
Yes, you get people, you pull people in, and then you let them go. You make people fall in love with the characters, and you end the scene.
That's kind of evil sounding. The way you say it, it's like a like a Bond villain almost. Yeah, no, that's true. I guess that's true. Well, why did that appeal?
Well, there's
to you?
An expectation. There's an expectation that as a writer, you're supposed to be nice, and I really like to undo that. and I think a lot of readers are kind of shocked, and they're also mad. I was reading. I shouldn't have done this, but I was reading Goodreads. Responses to my book, and people are so angry because they're like angry that I'm writing about ordinariness.
Oh.
How dare I put something ordinary and make it a story? Nothing happens, they say.
Nothing happens. I left each story feeling like something profound occurred. I never thought of it as nothing. Although sometimes the most profound things are nothing, to paraphrase
right.
the television sitcom Seinfeld. I mean, on some level,
right?
Nothing is something.
I love Seinfeld.
So do I. I do too. I just finished Jerry's new book, the volume, the collection of all his comedy bits, so he's been on my mind a little bit. Mm. But I do think, like, that show wasn't the first, certainly in prose, there's been a lot of nothing that is something. So I don't think you are, that's a weird sort of singular assessment. I mean, lots of people do this. And so, okay. So the power dynamic you enjoy as an author of creating these worlds and these characters and then controlling them for a little bit and then just say you're on your own. Something about that appealed to you.
And also, I don't give my readers any bearings. I don't tell you where you are or like what city these stories take place. I mean, some of them you can tell because I refer to like Canadian Tire.
Yeah.
But most of them, I just refer to it as with the word here. So the book has been published in the US and the UK. And in the US, in reviews, they say it's in America, like immigrants and refugees in America. Mm. And in Canada, they say immigrants and refugees in Canada. But I don't really give readers a specific place.
So you accomplished your mission in that sense. If two countries are saying, well, this takes place here, that's quite an accomplishment for you, I would say. Because do you have any kind of, I don't know, some authors, some writers, particularly Canadian writers, we've been raised to sort of, you know,
to think of place.
Well, to invoke regionalism of some sort. Yeah. Yeah. It sort of seems to be your duty bound as a Canadian writer to reflect Canada. But to your point, like, these are stories primarily about immigration, primarily about, I mean, so this is where we're coming from. But this is where I'm coming from with this at this point, because I think earlier you invoked this notion of fiction. But how steeped in reality are these anecdotes to either your own experience with your own parents or stories from your community? Is it some amalgam of reality and fiction, would you say?
Well, I think anytime you create fiction, you have to know those experiences or those feelings. If a reader feels sadness or loneliness or isolation or anger or love, those are feelings that I've known in real life, and I've put that into the fiction.
Right.
Also, I feel like everybody has these stories about parents getting things wrong. But, you know, to tell it, you can usually do that within 2 minutes and then the story's over.
Yeah.
But to put it into a book of fiction and make it a short story, you need more than the story. You have to have style and a sense for voice. You make artistic choices. You don't just say.
Yeah, the simple. Yeah, that's fair. I can think of experiences I've had with my parents who were immigrants, and I guess you would call them mistakes, but they were really just, I don't know. As I get older, I really relate more to my parents. As a parent myself, I relate more to them, but then, yeah, I don't know. I was kind of, were you a bad Canadian child of immigrants on any level? Were you like, there's a sequence in the book where I believe, a daughter says to her mother that you are so embarrassing. And you know, I that's not my name. Like, she's referred to by her formal name, but the daughter is adopted like a Canadian, you know,
Celine. Yeah.
Yeah, Celine, like a sanitized white Canadian name. And I remember only 20 years ago, one of my uncles in Scarborough, his name is Manu. But all of a sudden, out of nowhere, after years of being Manu at work, his business card started to say Mike.
Right.
And his kids, who were like in their 20s by this point, mockingly, I went over there. We were over there once for a family gathering, and they'd be like, "Hey, Mike! Hey, Mike, we need more beer, Mike." And like, I was like, "Oh, no. What happened?" And so that sanitization story, if you will, aspect of the story I could relate to, but there is this sense of everyone, I think, can relate to whether they're children of immigrants or not. They can relate to feeling embarrassed by their parents. But there seems to be a particular sharpness, I think, in my recollection of feeling embarrassed. What was I embarrassed about? It wasn't just that they were my parents. It's that they were foreign to the other kids I was hanging out with. Did you have that as a child at all?
Well, how powerful in the story to feel that and to have the courage to say it to a parent's face. But also in the story, how powerful for a woman to say, you know, do you think I want to be a mother?
Yes, that's right.
The story ends with her saying, no one wants to be a mother, but you can't know that until you are actually one. So there's the daughter trying to make it about herself and her own shame of her mother and her mother's difference. And then the mother changes it around and says something that is equally hurtful.
Yeah, which is not something you usually experience. That is
right.
Yeah.
Because usually in stories where children are ashamed of their parents, the parent, you end it there. You don't continue with a scene where a parent can turn it around and remind you that they are, at the end of the day, your parent, and they made a choice too.
I mean, earlier in our conversation, I invoked the notion of trauma as it relates to immigration. And I wonder if that is, I've just been thinking about that a lot in terms of my own lived experience and thinking more about my parents and the fact that they immigrated from India to Canada. But is trauma, when I think of the characters, there's a lot of trauma, there's a lot of rage. Even a story is sort of as sweet on some level. It starts out sweet anyway, of a mother who becomes infatuated with Randy Travis after arriving in a Western country. There is some real darkness to that story, and I do think it's a bit of repressed. There's something going on emotionally with someone who wants to fit in so badly in a new place that she gloms on to, you know, it's a very unrealistic sort of relationship she develops with a country singer. And so
she's also holding on to the gamble, right? When you move to another country that is so far away, in a way you're making a gamble. It's a risk. In the same, there is no guarantee that you will have a home or that you would do well or that you will fit in just in the same way as loving or wanting to be loved by someone famous who doesn't know who you are.
Yeah, yeah. There's,
so the mother is like that feeling of never being loved back or seen even. She's holding or she lives in that spot where it is, she just lives with those feelings and she can't change.
Yeah. And it becomes this sort of metaphor for immigration, I would think, to come to a place and not be accepted by the people who are here on some level. I don't want to get too English essay on you.
Well,
this.
Also it's for me, it's been really interesting to see the reaction. I find that readers who have had safe and good lives see only the trauma in the book, but there are people who have experienced trauma and all they see are the little triumphs. So you know, I've seen people's reactions and they're all very different. And for me, the story of Randy Travis is really about making a man that we've never even heard of become Randy Travis for us. For me, like the joy of writing is I am going to use the power or the fame that is Randy Travis, and I'm going to give it to a man we've never heard of. And we're at the end of the story, we're going to, as an audience, we're going to long and wish for this man to take the stage. And we do, and in the end, that's what we do.
Yeah.
We forget actually about Randy Travis.
Right, because someone else has conformed to the notion of what Randy Travis is and stands for.
Right.
Yeah, that is a fascinating aspect of this. I actually just want to, I know these are short stories, so it's difficult to summarize the whole action of the book, but just your, can you, in a summarily way, I suppose, how would you characterize the way you've depicted men and women in this book, because I feel like there's definitely different stuff going on where the men are either hapless or they are, you know, there's a lot of pride going on there. Even the title, How to Pronounce Knife, is a play on a father who thinks he knows something, I would say. And yet the women, I think, are on a different plane. There's all sorts of there's an emotional dynamic to the women in each story that is fascinating to me as well. There's the fitting in, there's the asserting of oneself, there's the kind of allegiance to maybe their home country. There's a lot going on. Again, it's hard. Sorry. Hard to summarize. But can you, do you see a distinction between the way you've depicted men and women in particular?
Yes. I think the men are tender and loving, and the women, they are not ones who are quiet. You know, whenever we see female characters in the movies or even in literature, they're some side bit, or they are the quiet ones.
Yeah.
The ones who bow their heads and do their work. But the women in my stories, even when they're little girls, if somebody calls them sexy, they'll say, I'll cut it off. We'll see what's sexy then.
Yeah.
Or if someone wants them to have, you know, some romantic life, they'll say, what, you want me to, like, just get some guy and have him pump me like a hog? I mean, mm-hmm. like, these are lines that I purposely wrote, and I want to see them said out loud by women.
And there's the dynamic between, I think, predatory men or power dynamics, where, you know, men objectifying women or taking advantage of their position, and in some cases women kind of maybe going along with it or being oblivious to that aspect of what's going on.
Not oblivious. I wouldn't say the women are oblivious, but it's a transaction.
They recognize,
they're the ones who are in power.
Right.
Like in Paris, even though the boss thinks he's the one who's in charge, it's really the women. And even in the school bus driver, where she is also with her boss, but she's also the one in power.
Well, I feel like the bus driver is... It's interesting. I came away from the bus driver feeling sad for the bus driver. and not...
But like, should you?
I don't think so. I guess not.
Because what is real love? Is it someone who's just there for a couple of months, or someone who's forever?
Yeah.
And in some ways, he knows more about love than that coffee time boss will ever know.
Right, right. Right.
What, like, would that coffee time boss ever tolerate what happened to him?
Yeah. We're getting into some very specific details about stories that I really want people to read.
Okay.
So I appreciate the insights, because it is a little complicated in a sense to talk about a series of short stories on an hour long podcast, because part of me wants to go through each story with you, but I also don't want to ruin this wonderful award-winning book for anyone who hasn't encountered it yet. So I do appreciate your insights here. Just to wrap this line of questioning up, do you see yourself, like, again, I know that as the creator of these worlds, you're drawing from your sense of real life and maybe your own experiences on some level. Do you see yourself in any of these protagonists in any way?
I do. I mean, I do feel like I am all these characters. Like, I have been that school bus driver, you know. I write a story about a person who picks worms. And I know the love of worm picking. I know what it's like to do a job and to be the best at it and to have nobody notice it. Those feelings, I know, and I put them into a story. Mm. I know that especially in fiction, people care so much about the private life of the author. These stories feel very real, but I think that's the magic of making a story. How do I make it feel real to someone else?
Yeah.
And I don't, you know, I don't want to take away from a reader any sense of that magic by telling them the truth of my life or the truth behind the work.
Fair, yes.
Like I've said this before, when we see a beautiful sunrise, just enjoy the light. Why ask, you know, where it comes from, how that works.
I think when in the realms of sort of fantastical storytelling, I think it's easier to presume that this is a conjuring by the creator, whereas a volume of short stories where the author might be from, let's say, Laos, and many of the protagonists seem to be from Laos, there is a natural compulsion to be like, oh, like, is this, are these stories that maybe emanate from your, if not your firsthand experience, at least your community on some level. That's all.
I understand that, but it's also, it's kind of dangerous for the author, because what if I wanted to write about some old man who just fixes cars? Then who I am as a person will disappear, you know, like I'm narrowed into writing a particular thing. Like these stories I wrote is because I'm a writer, not because of, I mean, they are informed by the life that I have and where I come from. But at the end of the day, they are also really stories. And that's what I did, what I made. And if I want to change my subject matter or my theme, the thing I make will still be good, because at the end of the day, I'm just a writer.
Has any, let's call them dumb, has any dumb interviewer ever asked you, is this poetry book about you? Did I do that?
I wouldn't call that dumb. I would call it like a curiosity.
Sure.
A valid one too. I mean, as a reader, I want to know, you know, it does lend a feeling of authenticity, but also it gives the writer a kind of right to write on these themes.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, and this group of people, because what if I wasn't from, if my family wasn't from Laos, or what if I wasn't a refugee and I'm writing these stories, it would be a cause for pause and question.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I think there is an increasing scrutiny of authenticity in cultural work, because some people have appropriated things for so long that there's a kind of knee-jerk reaction of like, where is this coming from? Like,
absolutely. Yeah. And so I understand. That's why I never feel those questions of, you know, is this about you? I don't feel like it's a stupid question.
Okay.
It's one of curiosity, and also of wanting to know why you're doing this, and if you're the right person to do it.
Yeah, I guess it's more a question of practice and sort of methodology, even, you know, on some level. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just asking those questions. On that note, are you, now that you've had a taste of fame and fortune, are you still a practicing poet?
That is the thing that, you know, brought me to writing. I am writing poems, and I think about it all the time. It never, even when I'm writing prose, you know, when I open a scene or close a scene, all the things that I learned from poetry come to mind, or what I learned to do there, I can draw from all the time. So I'm always thinking with that frame in mind.
Okay. You know, a lot of people, when they encounter any creative person, and they wonder, we were just talking about, like, people wonder where something comes from. And I haven't yet asked you this, but since we're on the topic of maybe your practice, I didn't get a chance to ask you this. Like, how did you begin writing on some level? Like, how did you, that's a real obstacle for a lot of people, and, you know, how do you start? How did you?
You're right.
How did you think you could even do this? Do you have a recollection of that moment for you, that spark?
Well, you know, usually when we decide to become something, or when we choose a vocation, you know, our parents know people, like, you know, they themselves do it. Like, if we want to be a teacher, you know, you go talk to a teacher and ask them how that happens. For me, my parents, if I wanted to box, store furniture, or pick worms, or work in a chicken processing plant, they knew the exact people to talk to who could make that happen. But to be a writer, that was, they didn't know anybody who was a writer, and I didn't either, but I knew things like a bookstore and a library. And I really didn't know how one becomes a writer. I just knew that I really loved writing. And I grew up in a time where of zines and
do it yourself kind of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I just printed and bound my own books. And I just went to bookstores in Toronto and said, will you carry my books? And I sold my books out of my school knapsack. That was a normal thing to do. That was before, you know, social media, things like Twitter or Instagram or Facebook, where you could just post a poem and then maybe someone will discover you.
At that time, I just
printed and bound my own books and sold them at small press fairs or to anybody I knew, like my dentist. And that's how a publisher discovered me, and she published my poetry.
You sold books to your dentist? No one likes their dentist. You actually made a point of selling your wares to the dentist?
Well, I knew he made money. I mean,
oh, he had money. That's a good...
I mean, they charge a lot for dental work. So what's $5?
I see. You were like, I'm gonna get a bit of this money back from this guy. I get it. Okay, that's interesting. There's a stereotype about immigrants that I think is steeped in some truth. Immigrant parents, I should say, in particular, that in my experience, they really were hoping I did something practical with my life. Practical.
Like, become a doctor.
Yeah, or a dentist. A dentist that can afford poetry books. So my thing is, I always know that the subtext of practical is do something that makes you money, because we came here with nothing, and we know what it's like to not have money. So you should do something that makes you money. And I think the other subtext was, and then at the end of our lives, maybe you can support us.
Right.
We don't want to, we're on our own here the whole time. Shouldn't you be? Anyway, did your parents, like, it sounds like you went to them on some level hoping for some guidance as to whom to talk to, but were they ever like, poet, writer? What, why are you doing this?
My parents, the most important thing for them was to get an education.
What
I did with it, they just thought I would end up making money anyway, or just having a job if I got educated.
I see.
And the minute I entered like kindergarten, I had more education than my parents.
Right.
So for them to tell me what to do with, you know, my education, they were just happy that I went to school, and they knew that whatever I ended up choosing to do, you know, I would be okay. Yeah, there was never any pressure for me to be a doctor or a lawyer, and nobody, you know, was obsessed or said anything about, well, I think also my parents didn't know that, you know, writers don't make money.
So, yeah, right.
So they were just like, oh, you know, like they, to that, you know, when you don't, when you are a family who's not rich, like when you don't have $10, it's the same thing as not having $1 million. Mm-hmm. You just don't have it. Mm-hmm. And for my family, they're just we're so proud that I went to university and that I have a degree, and whatever, you know, I chose to do with it, they thought I would be fine. But, you know, I didn't always write books. For years, I worked in the research department of an investment advice publisher, and I prepared taxes.
Oh.
So, you know, they always, I remember winning awards for preparing taxes. And my dad said, and when I told him, he said, oh, isn't that just, you know, what you do? Like, whatever I chose to do, he meant that I would be good at it.
Wait a minute. Have you won awards for every single thing you've ever done?
Not every single thing I've ever done, but just...
I'm obviously exaggerating, but who?
I've never
spoken to someone who's won both the Giller Prize and an award for preparing taxes. That is a little unusual, I have to say. That is a remarkable CV. I will say also, like, my God, your parents must be astonished. Again, I don't mean to be crass here, but there's a hefty cash prize that comes with winning the Giller. They must have been like, what? Oh, my. What was their reaction?
Well, my dad, I didn't tell my parents anything about the Giller because they're, you know, there are people in the world that do not know what the Giller is.
Sure.
So, and you know, my parents are one of them. So if I told them about the Giller, they'll just say, oh, what is that? And, you know, that would just kind of break my heart.
Right.
So I wanted to keep it private. But then, you know, I won and I didn't even tell them I was in the running. They saw it because my parents watched CP24.
For those who don't know, this is like it's not a static news channel, but it's like a website. It's a TV channel that's basically, it's got a news, three or four news tickers and the weather and then a talking head in the top left. And the traffic, it's like everything you would want.
Everything,
and it's just blasting information at you constantly.
If you go to the dentist or any doctor's office, they play CP24.
Pizza places often will play it. Yeah, just, yeah, that's right. So
and that's where my mom and dad saw me talk, you know, in my acceptance speech.
Wow.
They saw it aired on CP24 and they saw the cash prize and they were, and so to them they were like, my dad said that I had become famous, so he just thinks of the Giller as something that makes you famous.
Sure, and, sure it does that's not wrong.
And he just says, oh, so people know about people like us. And he says that he was very proud. And my brother noticed that his friends actually called him and said, your sister is trending on Twitter. And, you know, if we know anything about Twitter, you do not want to be trending on Twitter.
That's correct. That's normally true. Yes.
But in my case, that was like really good news. And so that's how he found out about it. He's a welder who lives in Windsor. And his coworkers were telling him about this prize. And then suddenly he's never bought any of my books, but suddenly he put in an order for a whole bunch to give.
Oh, huh.
And I was like, well, he's reading me.
That's interesting because, like, in my totally external position reading your stories, I wanted to try to figure out a way to relate those stories to you and your life. So to have your family read them, I'm sure they will have a very unique relationship with these stories, because I imagine for them, they'll be like, oh, yeah, I can picture who that might be, or I remember some semblance of that episode. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. Like, actually, a cousin of mine, because it was loosely based on my dad, and a cousin of mine said, oh, I remember this, you know, my dad often told stories at parties. He was the center of people's attention.
Yeah.
And my cousin had said, oh, isn't that your father? But I didn't remember. I mean, he just assumed it was. And but even, yeah, people in my family think it's about them.
Yeah.
Which is funny because, you know, actually now everybody thinks it's about them.
Well, that's when you make something that's open to interpretation.
Right.
And even
when it's not about a particular person, that particular person thinks it's about them,
which
is also really funny.
Yeah. Well, has anything else sort of, not that anything else needs to happen to how to pronounce knife, it's done very well for itself. But often when I speak to authors, they end up telling me yeah, I put out this book and now it's been optioned for this and it might turn into this other thing. Is there any sense that something might happen to the stories and How to Pronounce Knife beyond its life as a collection of short stories?
There's been discussion about turning the short story collection into a television show.
Right.
Where all the story, but where there's like a large cast of characters, but it doesn't star one particular person, but just like an ensemble cast of something like a show that can also inspire several locations and scenes. Yeah. Oh, I had in mind, I mean, the way that they talked about it was something like Lost, but without, you know, the supernatural stuff.
Well, right, where it's serialized, but each episode is its own sort of thing.
Yeah.
Right.
And new people. And I really like the idea of how something I wrote in private by myself could create jobs and opportunities for artists in other fields, like where an actor or a director or to create a room of writers. That's what I'm excited about.
Yeah, it's a remarkable thing you've done in that regard, for sure. You did the solitary work is now resonating with people, not only readers and, you know, award juries or whatever, but like you're right. That's a really interesting take on it. Like you might create a little ecosystem of work and creativity. That's great. That's remarkable. You must feel awesome.
And I think one of the lovely things I've seen though are people who don't see themselves as a writer in countries, you know, very far from Canada. Mm-hmm. I've heard from a young woman in Botswana who read about McGiller Prize win and she felt inspired about being a writer herself. You know, I've never been there. The fact that my book or this event or that it won this prize could reach that far and reach someone I've never met and inspire them. I'm excited about that something I made could inspire someone to see themselves as a maker of a thing.
Yeah.
And so
that's
what I'm really excited about too. Or just I have been asked what makes these stories Canadian. And I said, these stories are Canadian because I'm Canadian.
Yeah.
And I didn't know at the time how moved people would be by it. Like they think when you talk about being a Canadian that you are supposed to be white.
Right.
And to have someone who isn't say that, well, you know, these stories are Canadian because I'm Canadian, and to say that you're Canadian, that I've seen reactions from diplomats living in Tanzania being proud, being excited about the book because of what it represents of the country itself.
Yeah.
And so it's not, I've seen reactions where people are excited, not just because it's a book, but because it feels like something outside of itself that is meaningful to a lot of other people who aren't necessarily involved in publishing or writing.
It's interesting. It's an interesting way of putting it, because if I didn't know you and know the context of where this book was written, I would not particularly, it would not tug at my, first of all, I don't have very many patriotic heartstrings, but I just never really think of things that way myself. So it's fascinating to hear you say you somewhat purposely did not set it in any particular era or place, except for a couple of references here and there. And
I also didn't work in a major theme that is very Canadian. Like when a Canadian writer writes, they often write about the weather, or landscape, and I devote but two lines to such things in my book. But I did it on purpose, because I want to say that you can write like this and still be Canadian.
Well, it's been very, it's very effective, if I might say. It's a wondrous first blast of prose and fiction. And I see by the book flap here, at the end of it, in your biographical information, it says that you are working on your first novel. Is that true?
Yes, yes.
It's not a lie. That was fact-checked before I made it onto the book flap. That's all I'm getting at here. What is your progress there on the novel at this point?
Well, you know, I actually wrote a draft in 6 weeks. I just thought, you know, I have the time. I want to get this done. And I want to see what I'm capable of in this short time. Mm-hmm. And I was supposed to deliver the novel in December, but then I won the Giller. And so I was distracted.
yeah.
And so it's been pushed back to April, where I deliver the manuscript to the novel.
Okay.
I'm excited because it's new territory for me as a writer.
I see. Definitely a departure from the themes in How to Pronounce Knife.
Not necessarily, because it is about a boxer.
Oh, okay.
It's similar to Manny Petty.
Oh, okay. Interesting. The Manny Petty story is really fascinating, actually. And a very interesting sibling power dynamic as well. Again, I'm trying to be guarded in what I say about everything because I want people to read it. But that's a very fascinating story. Okay. Boxing fascinates you generally.
Yeah. Well, to get the boxing right, I spent a year and a half like boxing.
Oh, wow.
And that was very fascinating. I love, you know, like in boxing, you can't wait around for inspiration.
No,
When you get in the ring, everything you've ever known and anything anyone's ever told you just kind of kicks in instinctively, and you move and or you get knocked out.
I was very obsessed with boxing as a child and a teenager because my friend Richard loved boxing. And so we would go and watch every fight. We'd have to go to restaurants, you know, to watch the pay-per-view fights or whatever they were. And so I just watched every single, up to a point, I watched like every major boxing match. And my father spoke admiringly of Muhammad Ali, so I read all about Muhammad Ali. And so boxing is, I don't relate to it now, unfortunately. Or not unfortunately, I don't know. It's pretty brutal and terrible. I think the more you learn about sort of CTE and what are we doing, you know. And then there's some, obviously some racist stuff going on there as well. Racism, it's very complicated, but Ali was and is a hero to me, and I'm ashamed, I guess, to say how much, it's weird how much time I devoted to Mike Tyson as a kid, given who he ended up being. But boxing was, that's fascinating. I can't wait to read that, and I hope that the draft goes well for you. That sounds exciting.
Yeah. I want to make things harder for myself.
That's a good impulse.
And this is something that I've made harder for myself. Like, I'm walking into something I know very little about, and I'm learning from it all the time.
Was Manny Petty one of the last stories you wrote for your book?
One of the last stories was Edge of the World. Okay. No, Manny Petty was like maybe the third short story I wrote. Yeah.
Okay, I only ask because I find it fascinating that you vaguely took that story as a leaping off point for a jumping off point for a novel. It just suggests to me that something about it didn't leave you and spoke to you.
Yeah.
And I know it's early days, but have you already had a sense? Because that happens a lot with creative people. They're doing something, and then there's a kernel within what they're doing that launches them into a whole other thing. They might finish that thing they're doing, but there's something, the little thing sticks out to them and resonates with them enough that they want to pursue it in a longer form, which is vaguely what you're describing with Manny Petty in this novel. Have you, in the process of writing the novel you're currently working on, do you see something else coming? Do you like, there's something in there that's not for this story, but I want to maybe explore that somewhere else. Has that already happened?
Yeah, like a memoir.
Okay, there you go. All right.
Because, you know, so many people are interested in the life behind the work. And so I want to save those replies or responses for a book of its own. So I haven't, like, talked a lot about my own life. But also, you know, I want to get old.
Yeah, there's a yes, right.
Yeah, and one thing I want to do is, like, travel to Thailand and Laos and to see, because I think if I went there when I was 16 or 10 years old, I mean, I don't think I would have, like, the intelligence or the emotional range to understand what's happening or to be able to put it into words. So I'm thinking of that in the future.
It's always been the source of some friction between my parents and I, because in my 20s and 30s, they would make these trips to India and they wouldn't even tell me they had planned them. And I'd say, well, I'd like to go with, like, I'm not going to go by myself, I don't think. I don't think I could handle it. I don't know the languages well enough. I know them a bit, but I just was like, well, we should all go. Like, can I go? My wife, would want to go. Yeah. And they were like, oh, I already booked the tickets and it's too late. Oh. I'm like, oh, okay. And so yeah. And now, I mean, who knows if that's an interesting thing to aspire to, given what we're going through right now. But anyway, this the book is excellent. And I really appreciate this conversation. Sue, I do want to ask you, you're not really on social media, are you?
No, because I don't know, maybe I'm old and, like, that's not how someone my age, like, we like to talk to people.
I'm old. There's plenty of old people who use it.
And I think because, no, this is why, because I think, I mean, I understand. Yeah, I've been told by some of my publishers that I need to be more of a presence on those things. But I really am old fashioned. Like, I want all my energies to go into writing books. And I also, I think a writer should have some mystery to them.
Yeah, sure.
Like, if you know what I eat for breakfast, will you want to read my books? Because.
Right, sure.
Are you curious about what I'm doing if I'm telling you all the time?
But this does not preclude you from doing interviews?
No, I don't think so, because I think with an interview, I know how to remain private.
Right.
I think.
Right. But the temptation of social media might be to divulge too much, perhaps.
Not necessarily. I don't want people to feel like they could just reach out.
I get it. Yeah. And I'm not advocating for it. We've read enough about it in the process.
I guess
it's not healthy really for us to be on it. And it's something we're all negotiating on some level, but it's not really that great.
I mean, I am on Facebook and I had to join Instagram because I had to do an Instagram live chat with somebody and I didn't know what that was at all. So, like, I really didn't know how to do that at all.
No, it's fine.
I posted, but also sometimes I am on Facebook because my mom and dad and my brother are on Facebook.
Right.
And also I like people's birthdays and my own birthdays when, on Facebook. It's so lovely when everyone says happy birthday to you.
It should be called birthday book. It's really the only, it's the only reason I do it. Like I do begrudgingly still, not begrudgingly, but I do this show. So I will post about that on my own wall, but otherwise I don't really do anything anymore with it. And it used to be just a daily thing. And now I spend most of my time on Instagram for some reason, which is owned by Facebook. So it's it is complicated.
Yeah.
But so all this to say, you don't necessarily want people to follow you on Instagram, but if they wanted to, they could.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's kind of but I look really cruel on Instagram because I have something like 570 followers, but I only follow like 7.
That's fine. You don't. Sorry. Again, this is not.
Do I have to follow people?
No, no. Like,
will
it's
they,
not. No.
Will their feelings be hurt?
No.
I mean, don't know.
They will. Okay. I think there will be people who's. Oh, you know, I had a nice conversation with Sue at the party, and I followed her on Instagram, and then she didn't follow me back. Sure, there will be people who feel that way. I guarantee it. I've felt that way. People, it's a weird, maddening thing where you're like, oh, I thought I had a nice rapport with this person or whatever. Or, yeah, it's bad. It's very bad. It's all very bad. I'm not suggesting
it's
you
like
should.
Feelings.
Feelings
that you don't really need to feel.
No,
if you had a great conversation with someone.
Yeah, that should be enough. But it's bad.
Yeah.
But the whole system is like likes and notifications of likes. And it's really catering to your worst sort of conscious and subconscious instincts and impulses. Like, it's not good. So don't. All I was getting at with this, and this, I didn't expect this. I normally wrap up these things by asking my guests to like promote themselves a little bit. So if you want people to follow you on something, or do you even have a website, Sue?
I do have a website.
Would you want people to know about that?
I don't want it to crash. No, I'm just kidding. yeah, sure. It's should I send it to you or
no? Just say it. What is it? You can. Where people are listening. What is it? What is the website?
It's very long. It's my first name and then a hyphen and then my last name .com.
That's fine. That's fine. You could. That's.
And again, it's very old fashioned. So when you go on the website, it's not just a bunch of bugs. You actually have to bring a mouse over, and then when the mouse touches that bug, it'll tell you what section of the website you're on. It's not really phone friendly.
Is this what you meant by send you when you said send me the website? You wanted to send me the instructions to how to use your website?
Well, no, the address.
The address. I know. Yeah. I was making
but
a joke.
But also, as I was talking about the address, I realized, oh, but maybe some people may not know how to navigate it.
Sue, where on the internet can we find the instruction manual to using your website? I think everyone here would like to know. The book is out on McClelland and Stewart, and I think you can learn more about it at penguinrandomhouse.ca. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. And the book is a wondrous award-winning. It's the winner of the 2020 Scotiabank Giller Prize. The book is called How to Pronounce Knife. Sue, I really can't thank you enough for this time and this conversation. It's been nice to reconnect with you. I hope you enjoyed this conversation, and I wish you the best of luck with everything in the future.
I did. Thank you so much for inviting me on your show. It's always a pleasure.
Very, very special thanks again to Suvankam Temavongsa for appearing on this, the 592nd episode of Creative Control, which is part of the Entertainment One Podcast Network and is available wherever you get your podcasts. If you can't find an episode you're looking for, or if you want to learn more about me and sign up for my monthly newsletter, which is due out soon, actually, I'm sorry, I haven't got that out yet. But anyway, yeah, you can, what did I say? You can learn about me, you can sign up for my monthly newsletter. Oh, yeah. And you can, what else? Is that it? Yeah, those are the things. Learn about me. Find an episode you can't find. Sign up for my monthly newsletter. You can do all of that on my website, vishkana.com. You can also like Creative Control on various social media platforms. You can also follow the show on Twitter, at vishcreative, or follow me directly on Twitter and on Instagram, at vishkana. I followed Sue. We'll see if she follows me based on her little thing there at the end, but so far she hasn't. I don't begrudge this. Anyway, also, please consider visiting patreon.com/creativecontrol to make a flexible monthly donation to keep this podcast going. $6 or more grants you access to exclusive content, and if you're interested in receiving a Creative Control t-shirt, please message me on Patreon and I'll get you one while supplies last. That's all for $6 or more a month. But you can also, like I say, it's flexible. You can change it at any point. If you started out at $6 and you want to go down to $4, or if you want to go up to $40 a month, whatever it is that you want to do, you can do it. Again, patreon.com/creativecontrol. Thanks again to liveatmasseyhall.com, where you can watch beautifully captured concerts by great Canadian artists, and also to Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton for their in-kind support for this show. As always, thanks to my dear old friend, Jim Guthrie, for letting me use one of his songs. It's the instrumental version of The Rest Is Yet to Come that's playing behind me right now. But Jim lets me use all sorts of music on the show, and you can learn more about Jim and his work at jimguthrie.org. And finally, thank you for listening to this episode with Sue Vonkum and myself, and for subscribing to this podcast and suggesting to your friends that they do some of those things, if not all of them. You know, just spread the word about the show. All of that is very meaningful to me. So thank you very much. I will talk to you very soon. Goodbye for now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.